we could talk to the animals. Just imagine it, chatting with a chimp and chimpanzee.
This is Animals Today, featuring discussions about domestic pets, wild animals, and encouraging compassion and respect for all living creatures. Live from Palm Springs, here's Dr. Lori Kirshner.
Study every creature's language so I could speak to all of them on sight. If friends said, can he talk a crab or maybe pelican? You'd say like Kelly can, and you'd be right. So if you just stop and think of it, there ain't no doubt of it. I'm gonna win a place in history. A man who walks with the animals, talks with the animals, grunts and squeaks and squawks with the animals. And they could squeak and squawk and speak and talk to me.
Here, kitty, kitty. Hi, welcome to Animals Today. I'm Dr. Lori Kirshner. Thanks for tuning in. Yeah, in the news a week or so ago, it was reported that the city of San Francisco is considering banning the decline of cats on the grounds that the procedure is cruel. Now, I'm going to tell you what decline is in just a moment for those of you who don't know, because it's not just the removal of the nails, as the name sort of implies, or some people want you to think. You should first know that decline is pretty much legal everywhere in the United States, with the exception of, I believe, just two cities, one being in West Hollywood, California, where decline was banned in 2003. And by the way, the practice of feline decline is banned in many industrialized countries throughout the world, including England and Germany. Last season on Animals Today, we spoke the entire hour, actually, about decline with expert Dr. Jennifer Conrad, who founded the organization The Paw Project, which really works to rehabilitate big cats, lions, tigers, cougars, that have been maimed by decline. Her website's pawsproject.org. And if you care to learn more about her amazing organization, check it out, pawsproject.org. Dr. Conrad has been a proactive spokesperson advocating humane alternatives to declaw surgery and supported legislative efforts in California to ban feline decline, and was instrumental in this West Hollywood ban. Anyway, I learned a lot from Jennifer Conrad, and I'm going to briefly share with you some of what I would consider the most important points that she taught us. And of course, you can listen to the entire show online on the website animalstodayradio.com. You can listen to the hour on feline decline. All our shows from last season are up on the Animals Today website for your listening pleasure. Decline is not simply removing the cat's nails. That's what I originally thought. That's not what it is. You could think of decline, a cat, comparable, ready for this, to cutting off your fingers at your first knuckles. You think I'm exaggerating? I'm not. You take a look at the anatomy of the cat's paws, okay? And what a veterinarian does when he or she declaws is that they remove the last bone of each toe. So it's literally, by definition, amputating your cat's paws. So instead of declaw surgery, a more accurate term would be amputation surgery. And actually, to be just as descriptive and accurate with you, many opponents to this procedure call it a mutilation procedure. Would you want to do this to your cat? Now, let me tell you a bit about the cat's claws and how important the claws are to the cat's way of life. The cat's claws are one of their most important features. They use their claws, you know this, for climbing, playing, hunting. These claws have a very important role in the feline's social behavior. When you remove the claws of a cat, you're removing the most important feature of the animal that is central to the cat's natural, instinctive social behaviors. Decline takes away the most important characteristic that allows the cat to express a great part of what the cat is genetically and innately supposed to be, and consequently, it will also likely lead to a host of behavioral problems as well. So if that does not raise all sorts of ethical and moral questions surrounding this procedure, then I don't know what would. Declawing is painful, cruel, unethical, and unnecessary because there are humane alternatives to declawing to fix what people perceive as a problem of scratching and furniture destruction. In most cases, declawing is the first strategy chosen when a person discovers their cat is destructive or scratching. Well, actually, often the first strategy is to get rid of the cat, okay? But you know what I'm trying to say here. The amputation of a cat's paws is usually done only for the convenience of the owner. In addition, with some people, declawing is an immediate, preemptive response to the possibility of a cat's natural instinct to want to use its claws. The procedure itself, the amputation or mutilation of your cat, should be enough to convince people to not have this done on their pet. But if that doesn't convince people, then knowing there are humane alternatives to decline, how can there ever be any good reason for a person to want to declaw their cat? And again, if you missed the show on decline from last season and you want to listen to the hour or learn about more of the humane alternatives to declaw surgery, go to animalstodayradio.com and the shows are archived on our website. So as I mentioned earlier, the city of San Francisco is considering banning the declawing of cats on the grounds that the procedure is cruel, except, of course, in cases of medical necessity. Now, this ban idea has run into opposition from certain individuals and groups, and the San Francisco SPCA is one group that does not completely support this ban of declawing in their city. Of course, you must know for years the San Francisco SPCA has been doing incredible work trying to make their beautiful city a better place for their animals. And I'm so happy to have with us here on Animals Today the president of the San Francisco SPCA, Jan McHugh Smith. Jan is a recognized leader in animal welfare with 23 years of extensive experience in the field of animal welfare and education. Welcome, Jan.
Thank you. Thank you for having me today.
Thank you for being here. Jan, San Francisco is considering a ban of the declawing of cats. Could you give us a little background on this proposal in San Francisco?
Well, yes. Actually, it was brought forth in front of the Animal Welfare Commission a few years back. I think after Hollywood, it had success with declawing getting passed. And actually, at that time, it did not end up being legislated in the city. And what ended up happening is the Board of Supervisors provided a resolution opposing declawing and asking people to consider other alternatives. Just recently, now since the state veterinarians have put together this legislation that passed that's going to not allow local laws to be passed that will pick out different procedures in the veterinary practices, there was an opportunity for some of the local cat advocates to try to put forth declawing legislation between now and when the new legislation at the state level goes into effect.
Is this proposal similar to the law passed in West Hollywood in 2003?
Yes, I believe it is. They have a ban against declawing and then also a ability to be able to declaw if the animal has a severe medical issue.
Right. And, Jan, what is the position of the Humane Society of San Francisco regarding this proposal?
Well, the San Francisco SPCA is opposed to declawing cats. The surgery is not performed at our veterinary hospital, and we strongly advocate against the procedure, particularly when done so at the convenience of the cat guardian, as you were talking about earlier. We spend a lot of time with people educating them about how they can do alternatives to declawing. As you know, scratching is a natural feline behavior, and with a little time and commitment and training, cats can use to learn their claws in a manner that's normal for them,
right,
without causing destruction. So we counsel people about regular nail trimming. Matter of fact, we have cat nail trims a couple times a month for people to bring their cats in. We have scratching implements and help people to learn to train their cats to use them. Synthetic nail caps are also another alternative. So while we are opposed to declawing, and we don't adopt to people who are going to declaw, we're really concerned about this legislation being implemented at the local level instead of at the state level.
And why?
Well, because the problem is we really need to capture the hearts and minds of the veterinarians and cat guardians and work together to end declawing. And this is really not supported by the veterinarians of the state. Frankly, I don't know of any veterinarian in San Francisco that actually performs declawing. So what I like about the legislation is it's raising awareness about declawing and educating people even more. But my concern is that if we have local laws here or there, people get confused about what they can and cannot do. I'd rather see it be at a statewide level and having a real movement to end this.
Right. So you think just a baby step here doesn't help?
Well, I think it helps in raising the awareness. I don't think it's going to have an effect in San Francisco proper because, again, I don't know any vet in San Francisco that does this procedure.
Right. So, but even the awareness issue alone, just a baby step is you don't think that's better than nothing?
I'd rather see us put our efforts into doing it at the state level because without the veterinarian's support, they're the ones who make the decisions about and make recommendations to veterinarians about their practices and how their practices are run, how these procedures are or are not done.
Right.
So that's really where the work has to be done.
Yeah. No, I hear you. You know, there's some people that would say that this to ban declawing would lead to more abandonment of cats or euthanasia. Do you have any knowledge about that and what the effect in of the ban in West Hollywood was?
You know, I don't have any data on that about how that was affected. But what I do know is, you know, having worked in shelters for so many years, is that the cat overpopulation, cat abandonment problem is tremendous in America. It's probably the biggest problem we face around the United States. And so obviously we are concerned about that. We certainly would not want somebody to give up their cat.
Right.
They can't get it declawed. But ultimately, the SPCA believes that legislation isn't always the best action to take when it comes to trying to change people's behavior.
Yeah.
I mean, as you and I discussed, I think this is really a moral and ethical issue, and we have to continue to raise consciousness about the health and well-being of cats. And
exactly.
How are we going to treat them as a society?
Absolutely. I did read one or two things about this West Hollywood ban. Again, I don't know the exact statistics or numbers, but John Duran, I guess, who is the West Hollywood City Council member who actually led the push for the ban, said in this article that I read that the city has not, absolutely not, seen a surge in abandoned cats since the law took effect, which is good news if that's the case. John Duran was interested in the issue because he had one of his pets declawed 20 years ago, and he said he regretted that decision very much. His cat became skittish and stopped using the litter box, which we know can lead to behavioral problems. And he stated, "I didn't know what I was doing." And Duran hopes bans on decline will be common someday, just like you had stated, Jan. And he quotes, "I think a lot of this is about public education to try to change the animal to make us more comfortable. We just consider that inhumane." So, yeah, let's hope. Do you know, Jan, if the state proposal is in progress? What's going on?
Well, at the state level in California, right now, what has been passed and will go into effect is that these types of decisions cannot be made at the local level. So that's what that legislation is going to do. It would not allow individual communities to pick and choose what procedures can be done in veterinary practices, because the veterinarians say this is really a discussion between the cat guardian and the veterinarian, and so they want to make sure that veterinarians are sitting down having these very serious conversations with their clients about these procedures and that they're following consistent regulations around how these things are done. But again, in order to make a change like this, we really have to get the veterinarians on board, because they're our number one defense in helping people keep their pets. People see a veterinarian first, and that's who they're going to talk to, and that's who studies have shown pet guardians go to whenever there's a problem. So we really need to get our veterinarians on board, and I think many of them are, to help educate people and to give them the tools that they need to not declaw their pet.
Yeah, and then of course on the other side of this is just like medical doctors. I'm sure there's a lot of veterinarians who really are not looking into what's really ethical and best for the cat. They're probably just looking for financial gain, and I guess you get that everywhere. So you can't always depend on every single vet to give you the right advice, you know.
Yeah, but there's the California Board of Veterinary Medicine, and they're the ones who are making the decisions
yeah.
on these issues.
Yeah.
So they're looking at scientific studies. You know, they're trying to look at all the science behind all of this and make the best decisions.
Yeah. Why not a statewide ban? Why is there not?
Again, I don't know why not.
Okay.
I think that it would be something for the future.
Yeah, absolutely.
And again, you know, that would really have to come from the veterinarian community.
Got it.
And from pet guardians. We can all talk to our veterinarians about that, because they're all members of the California Veterinary Medical Association, and they can yeah. provide influence to help push these humane issues along.
Yeah. Jan McHugh Smith, president of the San Francisco SPCA, thank you so much for being our guest today on Animals Today.
It's my pleasure. Thank you for talking about this important issue.
Thank you for expressing your opinion about it. Up next, did you know that feline urinary problems are one of the most common problems that veterinaries treat? We will speak with Dr. Julie Fisher. She's a specialist in feline urinary conditions. I'm Dr. Lori Kirshner. You're listening to Animals Today on News Talk 920 KPSI.
Do you realize millions of animals are euthanized in shelters every year? The number one problem is pet overpopulation. There are simply not enough homes. That means too many unwanted dogs or cats. Desert Paws reminds you to be a responsible pet owner. Fix your pets and encourage others to do so. Fixed pets are less likely to run away. They also have a reduced risk of illness such as cancer. And if cost is a consideration, most communities have no cost or low cost clinics to have your pets spayed or neutered. And remember to adopt rather than buy pets. For more information, visit desertpaws.org.
Hi, welcome back to Animals Today. I'm Dr. Lori Kirshner. I want to welcome Dr. Julie Fisher. Dr. Fisher is from the Veterinary Specialty Hospital in San Diego in North County. She's a graduate of the University of Tennessee College of Veterinary Medicine. And in 2002, she established the UC Davis's Nephrology, Urology, and Hemodialysis Service in San Diego, which she coordinated until earlier this year. She is a nationally recognized expert in feline urinary tract problems. Welcome, Dr. Fisher.
It's great to be here.
Thank you for being with us. What do you mean when we say urinary disease?
Well, when we talk about urinary disease, we're really talking about anything that can be related to the entire urinary tract. And we divide the urinary tract into a portion that produces and transports urine, which would be the upper urinary tract, the kidneys, and the ureters, the tubes that connect the kidneys to the bladder,
mm-hmm.
and then the lower urinary tract, which is the bladder, which stores urine, and then the urethra, which helps conduct it to the outside world. And we divide it this way because diseases that affect these different parts of the urinary tract present in very different ways and have very different ramifications and consequences and management strategies for the animal.
Mm, and I want to talk about both the lower and upper urinary tract diseases.
Right.
Thank you for breaking that down for us. How common is urinary disease in cats?
It's really common. It's probably one of the more common reasons that I see cats presented for specialty medical services. And diseases of both the upper tract and the lower tract are quite common.
Why don't you start, if you would, with idiopathic feline cystitis?
I'd be happy to. This is a very common disease in cats, and I'm glad you called it idiopathic cystitis. It goes by a lot of other names. Many people know it as feline urologic syndrome or feline lower urinary tract disease, but some of us feel that that's not really specific enough, and it really is an idiopathic cystitis, meaning it's inflammation of the bladder, cystitis, and it's idiopathic. We don't have one very specific cause for it. And this is a disease that probably affects about 1.5% of all cats at some point in their lifetime.
Mm.
And it can be a disease that's very painful for the cats and very frustrating for the owners, and frequently results in relinquishment and sometimes even euthanasia. But what's important about it is our current understanding of it really makes it a quite manageable disease. These cats usually come in because they have what we call lower urinary tract signs. They're straining to urinate, they're painful, they may have blood in their urine, they may be urinating very frequently, or even urinating inappropriately outside of the litter box.
Go ahead, I'm sorry.
No, some of these cats just present with those signs, and some of these cats actually go on to block their urethras, so that they can't urinate at all and present with life-threatening disease because of the buildup of toxins that would normally be eliminated in the urine.
Now, are there? And I read something about two. It encompasses two sort of classes of this idiopathic feline cystitis: non-obstructive and obstructive. Do you ever break it down that way?
Sure. That's what I was just sort of touching on. Is some of these cats just come in with what we would call lower tract signs.
I see.
Those signs where they strain or they seem painful when they urinate or they have bloody urine. And then in the obstructive disease, the urethra actually becomes blocked with a plug of material.
Yeah.
So that they're not urinating frequently and because they can't urinate at all. So they frequently come in a life-threatening situation.
So it comes on suddenly, huh?
It can. The obstructive disease can come on suddenly. Some of the cats that develop obstructive disease have had some of these signs, like the straining to urinate or the bloody urine, for a while before then. And some cats have the non-obstructive form with these less severe signs for quite a while before the owner actually identifies it as something that really needs medical attention.
And causes of this, any known causes?
Actually, yes, and we a lot of time and effort and study in a lot of different veterinary centers in the country has gone into this disease because it is so complicated. But what we're coming to realize is that it probably has a more psychological component than we originally thought.
Mm.
It probably has more to do with the interaction of the brain and the nervous system.
Yeah.
I hear talking on the line.
Oh, we may have some crosstalk from background. Sorry about that.
That's okay.
A little technical. Let's just try to... Thank you. Sorry for the interruption.
Yeah, I didn't know if I was supposed to talk over him. So we think that there may be more of a factor of interaction between the brain and the bladder and the nervous system and the bladder rather than just something like a urinary tract infection, which directly affects the bladder itself.
Mm.
And actually, I'll talk a little bit more about the factors that cause it, but one really important point I'd like to make about this is that even though the non-obstructive form of this disease can sometimes show signs that are exactly the same as urinary tract infection, straining and bloody urine and pain with urination and frequent urination, this is not a bacterial disease, and antibiotics don't treat it.
Mm.
Because it can be a waxing, waning disease that comes and goes by itself, frequently when antibiotics are administered, it goes away, and the illusion of actual treatment and cure is provided by that. But bacteria really doesn't play a role in this disease process.
Interesting.
That's why when cats come in with these signs, a urine culture is important to help distinguish.
Ah, very interesting. So going back to causes then,
sure.
And how about diet or wrong diet, or can a particular diet lessen the chance of it occurring?
Yeah, there's a lot of information on this that it's a little bit mixed.
Mm.
We know that diet alone rarely resolves this for a cat. Definitely, we've seen the advent of lots of acidifying diets with this particular disease, and sometimes those will improve clinical signs for a given cat. One factor that we know absolutely does is increasing water in a cat's diet. And therefore, even just switching to a canned food from a dry food in cats with these signs will frequently help alleviate them. And part of the reason for that is probably just that feline urine is very concentrated, more concentrated than normal human urine is. And that concentration can be irritating, particularly to a bladder that's already irritated.
Oh, so
diluting the urine out of it often helps these cats. And I have definitely had cats with these signs that are essentially resolved by nothing more than increasing that cat's water.
Oh, interesting. How about like a high sodium diet or?
Some of the diets designed to do this are higher in sodium. Not all of us are convinced that large amounts of sodium in the diet of cats is necessarily the best thing to jump to immediately in these guys, because we haven't necessarily delineated what the effect of that on a cat is long term, and we know they get hypertensive just like people do. We just haven't really ferreted out everything that plays into that. But what we do know makes a big difference is environmental modification. And there's a school of thought that subscribes to multimodal environmental modification for these cats and have had great successes in managing this disease just by changing the cat's environment.
Like, give us an example.
You bet. Cats are predators, and they like to watch and perch. And sometimes even just giving a cat access to multiple levels, to high perches where they can sit and watch and get away from potentially stressful cat-cat interactions in the house when there are multiple cats in the house, can be very, very helpful. Litter box hygiene. Cats are very fastidious creatures, and some cats just will not eliminate in a litter box that is not clean. And so scooping litter boxes daily, if you have multiple cats in a household, having at least one litter box per cat, so that there's never any competition or territorialism, at least regarding the litter box.
So there's really, seems to be a big mental component here. Isn't it amazing just changing the environment can have such a huge impact on the effect of a disease process?
Well, it's true, and it's not necessarily that, I guess I want to clarify, it's not necessarily that anything that these owners are doing with these cats is causing this disease, but what these stressors probably do is unmask a propensity for this condition in a given cat, because we'll certainly have multiple cats in a household exposed to exactly the same kinds of either stressors or, you know, lack of capacity to have multi-level access, and one cat will show these signs and another cat won't.
So are there certain breeds that are more susceptible, or you think there's a genetic component here?
There may be a genetic component, but we don't necessarily see it in a breed-related fashion. This affects both sexes and all breeds. It does tend to be a disease of younger to middle-aged cats. But and usually when it's going to manifest in a given cat, it usually manifests in a young adult to middle-aged cat initially. It can persist into later years. But every breed seems to be affected by it.
If you're just tuning into the show, I'm Dr. Lori Kirshner. You're listening to Animals Today. We're talking with veterinarian Dr. Julie Fisher, an expert in feline urinary problems. You're listening to News Talk 920 KPSI. Dr. Fisher, can I rely upon my general vet to correctly make this diagnosis?
You probably can. It's a fairly common disease among cats. I would say that one of the things that I think is important in the initial management of this disease, if you have a cat that you present to your general vet with these clinical signs, is that delineation between bacterial and non-bacterial disease, and not just presuming that a cat who shows up with bloody urine or who's urinating frequently or painfully has a bacterial infection. And the reason I say that is because that initial designation really dictates one of two very different management courses and can help avoid a lot of frustration and, you know, save money and time and suffering for the pet overall. But yes, general practitioners can manage both bacterial disease and this feline lower urinary tract disease, the idiopathic cystitis.
And talk a little more about treatment options.
Really, for the non-obstructive disease, one of the biggest cornerstones for treatment is this multimodal environmental modification. And I think one thing that's really important for owners to understand is they have the power to identify the factors in their cat's environment that may be playing into this and the power to change it, and really giving them some control and some ownership of the situation and some involvement. This is not something that a veterinarian can necessarily change, because so much of it is related to household environment.
Yeah. Yeah.
Cat-cat interactions.
Right.
And it's going to be different for each cat in each environment. So it really is incumbent on the owner to take a good inventory of what may be affecting that cat's mental state, what its physical environment's like. The vet can certainly help provide a checklist. And I guess one resource I'd also provide to owners is the Ohio State University has a program called the Indoor Cat Initiative. And I believe the website is www.indoorcat. And I'm sorry, I don't know if
No, that's okay. No, but, Dr. Fisher, thank you.
But if you look up MEMO and Ohio State, you can find it. And it has some great suggestions for helping owners identify these factors and helping veterinarians as well.
Okay, so we spoke about the non-obstructive, and you said most of the early signs could be straining or bloody urine or painful when urinating. Frequent urinating. Let's talk a little bit about obstructive feline cystitis. How does that present?
Sure, and it frequently very dramatically. These cats are actually systemically ill much of the time.
Mm.
They may be vomiting. They may be hiding. Often owners will see the cat straining in the litter box, but the straining is unproductive because the cat's urethra is obstructed.
Mm.
Because of that, a lot of these cats are presented for constipation. The owner presumes that the cat is straining to defecate because nothing's coming out. And so any cat that seems to be straining to produce something in the litter box and seems to be upset about it should probably be presented for evaluation, especially if that behavior is accompanied by other systemic signs like lethargy, like not wanting to eat or vomiting, because none of those signs are consistent with just a bladder infection.
Mm.
And these cats often are presented truly on the verge of death.
Oh.
What happens when you can't eliminate urine from your body is not only can't you eliminate the dissolved waste products in the urine, but another important component of normal urine is potassium. And very high blood levels of potassium will actually stop the heart.
Yeah.
And when these cats do die of this, because they're not treated in time, that's what they die of.
Right, just the toxic effects from the urine, yeah. So this is really considered an emergency, and this can come on pretty quickly, huh?
Definitely. It can come on quickly. It's usually 12 to 24 hours before you start noticing any signs in the cat, but I would say the ones that present in life-threatening situations usually have been obstructed for a couple of days.
Mm.
And, yes, jumping on this immediately is important.
Right.
It is a life-threatening
Right, so good message for listeners there. If you feel your cat is ill or not acting normal, obviously you don't really even have 2 days to wait.
It's true.
So does this happen more in males?
Yes. The obstructive form is almost exclusively a disease of male cats. The non-obstructive form occurs in males and females, but because of the much larger diameter of the female feline urethra, they don't become obstructed by this particular disease. The male feline urethra is very narrow in the part that courses through the penis, and that's where these cats become blocked.
Oh, wow. And must be very, very painful.
It is. It's really painful to them. Fortunately, when we're presented with cats like this, the immediate course of action is right there in front of us. We need to relieve that obstruction.
Right.
And
how about anything we can do to prevent this in our cats?
Really, prevention for the obstructive disease
yeah.
is very similar to prevention of the non-obstructive disease. Environmental modification and absolutely increasing water intake. When cats with the idiopathic cystitis block, they're usually obstructing with a mixture, a matrix of crystals and mucus from the bladder. So this mucocrystalline plug in the urethra. And if we can dilute urine concentration, we can frequently decrease the concentration of those crystals in the urine and the propensity for making this plug.
So,
and diet does help some of these cats as well by helping to decrease the crystal content of
so
the urine.
So it's like a kidney stone in humans, almost like. It's just an obstruction.
Sort of.
Yeah, well.
Yeah, sort of. Some cats do obstruct actually with stones, but it's a bit of a different disease.
Right, right. Now, in terms of management, I know you said the first form of action is that a vet would do is to try to unobstruct them. So
exactly.
Some vets, I read, they recommend this procedure called a perineal urethrostomy when cats obstruct this way. What do you think about this procedure, and tell us about it?
Sure. A perineal urethrostomy is actually surgically removing the penis on the cat and creating a larger urinary opening right underneath the anus there. And physiologically and functionally, cats can do very well with this procedure. My personal feeling is that in a cat that seems to be intractably obstructing and has obstructed multiple times and none of the modifications that we're making seem to help resolve this issue, I think that's a very reasonable procedure to perform. Personally, I don't tend to recommend it until we've tried other things. Mm. And there are a couple of reasons that I feel that way. And there's definitely a variety of opinion on this topic. But the male feline urethra also helps prevent urinary tract infection in that cat. That narrow, long urethra helps keep bacteria from going up into the bladder in male cats. And in general, maintaining that normal anatomy is going to be a preferable situation for that cat if we can keep him from obstructing.
So what would be your first line of treatment?
My first line of treatment after the cat is unobstructed,
right.
and frequently they need to stay in the hospital for a couple of days on fluids to help get those toxins out of the body and get them back on track. I implement the other strategies that we talked about with the non-obstructed disease, but I lean very heavily in these cats on increasing water intake
okay.
and diluting their urine, and I do tend to recommend dietary changes in these cats to help decrease the amount of crystal in the urine.
Yeah.
But the environmental modification is key for these cats as well. And if I have an owner who says, you know what, I can't have this happen again, I can't afford to keep coming back to an emergency hospital, I can't deal with the fact that my cat may obstruct suddenly in the middle of the night, that may be a cat where it's perfectly reasonable to go to a perineal urethrostomy earlier.
Mm.
But a lot of owners really want to try and
sure.
start that surgery and are dedicated to implementing the other management strategies.
Sure, sure.
I favor that.
Dr. Fisher, how hard is it to make this diagnosis? Let's say it's 2 in the morning. I know if I see my cat suffering or having any problems at 2 in the morning or is critically ill, I'm going to bring them to my local emergency room if I can't mm-hmm. get a hold of my vet. Will they be able to figure this out, or will they be just totally leading me down a completely wrong path?
Pretty much any emergency vet who's been in practice for any amount of time will have seen many of these cats, and it's a very straightforward diagnosis to make. A basic palpation of the abdomen will reveal a rock-hard, painful bladder in the back of the cat's abdomen by the pelvis. And so it truly, this particular problem, the obstructive disease, really is a diagnosis that can be made very quickly on physical examination.
Wow.
And it's such a common problem, and that every student who's gone through vet school will look for it.
We're going to continue learning about the very common urinary and kidney problems that our cats face. Stay with us right here on Animals Today on News Talk 920 KPSI.
Hi, Ron and Annie in the Car Doctor. Let's have another motoring minute, shall we? Can dirty cabin air filters affect your breathing in the car? They sure can. Worse yet, missing cabin air filters in the car can also do just as much damage. In the last 5 or 6 years, cabin air filters have been a hot commodity, no pun intended. It's a filter that cleans the air actually entering the cabin of the vehicle so that you have a better time or an easier time breathing. It filters out contaminants that would normally adhere themselves to the car's heating or cooling system, which eventually works its way into the car's cabin and interior. As part of a regular maintenance schedule, make sure if your car has a cabin filter, it gets checked and changed if needed every 15,000 to 20,000 miles. Look in your owner's manual. Sometimes they're referred to as a cabin filter. Sometimes they're called a pollen filter. Sometimes they're called a heating, ventilation, and air conditioning filter. But if your car has one, proper maintenance is going to be easier on the car and you. With your Motoring Minute, I'm the Car Doctor, Ron Ananian.
Money talks, and it sounds just like Jim Cramer.
I'm Cramer. Money talks, and sometimes it shouts when the results speak for themselves.
Investors worldwide follow Jim Cramer's advice on TV, in books, and on websites like TheStreet.com. And whether the market's up, down, or sideways, Jim's always hunting down a bull market. And now you can follow Cramer's portfolio at GetCramer.com.
Okay, here's how it works. Every time I buy or sell, I will email you ahead of time. Did you hear me? Ahead of time! It's like, if you can read, you can read my mind! My portfolio fueled by my great research, is designed to deliver success. And I'll share it with you at GetKramer.com.
Today, you can sign up for 2 weeks of free access to Kramer's Picks and Portfolio. Just go to GetKramer.com and enter code word BUY. GetKramer.com. Free today. Go to GetKramer.com. Code word BUY.
We are talking about our world today. Oh, and someone's on the line.
Hi, I'm Jacqueline.
Welcome, Jacqueline. How old are you? You sound so young.
I'm 8.
Oh, wow. I assume you're a student, right?
Yes, from Jefferson Elementary. And I have a question.
Sure. And what's your question?
We all know the Earth has 7 continents that currently carry 193 countries. Those continents make up 29% of the Earth's surface, meaning that the vast majority of our planet, 71%, is comprised of water. Taking into consideration man automatically adapts to environmental conditions, why is it that I need to take swimming lessons?
Are you ready for kids who eat healthy? Good nutrition can lead to great things. To find out how a healthy lifestyle can help your child succeed, go to mypyramid.gov. A public service announcement brought to you by the Ad Council and USDA.
Sadly, many people abuse and mistreat their pets. They beat, kick them, or even starve them, and they get away with it. And while other people know about the abuse, many never report it. If you happen to see someone hurt, mistreat, or abuse an animal, or if you even suspect it, don't turn away. Make it your business to call your local humane authorities or the police department at once. Animals can't ask for help, but you can help them speak on their behalf when they're in danger. You'll probably save an animal's life. This message is brought to you by Desert Paws. Visit desertpaws.org.
You're listening to News Talk 920, KPSI.
We're speaking to Dr. Julie Fisher. She's a specialist in feline urinary conditions. We're talking all about urinary and kidney problems in cats, very common. You're listening to Animals Today. And Dr. Fisher, let's move on now to chronic renal failure in cats. Why don't you explain to us, please, what functions do kidneys normally perform?
Kidneys do so many things, and you'll have to forgive me because I'm completely enamored with them. They just are incredible, incredible organs. They are responsible for the elimination of dissolved waste. So they actually collect and excrete the dissolved waste that are accumulated in the bloodstream. And in doing so, they also regulate the balance of water in the body. They determine how much water is retained and how much is eliminated, electrolyte balance, so sodium and potassium and chloride, your acid-base balance in your body by eliminating acids and synthesizing and retaining bases like bicarbonate in the body. And they even perform endocrine functions. The kidneys are responsible for the synthesis of certain hormones. One hormone that is chiefly responsible for regulating red blood cell production, and then also vitamin D, which helps to regulate the calcium phosphorus balance in the body.
Very important organ. Right. How does chronic renal failure present?
It can present in a lot of different ways, and in fact, in many cats, we find it incidentally in a cat who's had screening lab work done as, you know, a middle-aged or older cat. But in some cats, we will find it, they'll present actually ill. And the illness associated with this disease usually is fairly non-specific systemic illness. And what I mean by that is these cats, they have a decreasing appetite or some weight loss or lethargy. And in more extreme circumstances, may come in vomiting or having diarrhea. Mm. But most of these cats are just dumpy and don't want to eat and have been losing weight and just generally ill.
And how does a vet diagnose it?
It's a diagnosis made with blood work and urinalysis. And so the kidneys normally will, especially in cats, concentrate the urine. So the urine that's produced is water has been extracted from it by the kidneys, so it's very concentrated. So when we see a cat that comes in with certain values on the lab work, most frequently a value called BUN, blood urea nitrogen, and creatinine, that are elevated, and that cat is also no longer concentrating its urine, we will make a preliminary diagnosis of renal failure. Well, it's not necessarily chronic at that point. It could be sudden and acute, but then other tests that we do, physical exam, feeling small kidneys, looking at them with ultrasound and seeing that the architecture has been distorted, help lead us to a diagnosis of chronic disease.
And what causes chronic renal failure in cats?
There may not be one specific cause, and we haven't necessarily identified all of the factors that are involved in it. But there are several things that we know can lead to chronic kidney disease in cats, chronic renal failure. One is an insult to the kidneys earlier in life. Let's say a cat ends up involved in a toxic situation, ingests either a lily for instance, and gets over that, there may still be damage to that kidney that leads to progressive disease down the line. There may be stimulation by antigens in the environment that lead to low-grade inflammation in the kidney that over time results in gradual destruction of the nephrons, the individual components that make up the kidney. But there's no one clear-cut cause that leads to this chronic kidney disease that we see in older cats most frequently, but sometimes even related to younger cats. Some cats are actually born with kidneys that are damaged already, and we call that congenital dysplasia, and those cats may have chronic renal failure as young as 2 or 3 years of age.
What does a diagnosis of chronic renal failure mean for my cat? I know I had a cat, the best cat in the whole world. I bet everyone says that. Truly the best, sweetest cat in the entire world. She did have it it was only diagnosed in the last few months of her life. That's, I think, what really just killed her. But what's the prognosis and what does it really mean?
The prognosis for this particular disease is highly dependent on which stage of the disease we diagnose it in. Once we make a determination that this is chronic kidney disease, this isn't just something that hit previously well-functioning kidneys out of the blue, this is something that's insidious and ongoing and progressed and irreversible, we break it down into stages, and we divide chronic kidney disease into stages 1 through 4. The earliest stage disease is when we just start seeing the cat lose the ability to concentrate urine, and we just start seeing that BUN and creatinine creep out of the normal range. To stage 4 disease, where the cat is quite ill, the creatinine value is much higher, and how these pets do and how long they can do well really depends on disease stage. A cat diagnosed in stage 1 might, at age 10, might live to be 18 years old and die of something completely different. A cat diagnosed at stage 4 is probably not going to survive for much more than 6 months or a year unless extreme measures are taken.
Mm.
So it's really variable. And how we manage the disease is quite dependent on what stage we diagnose the cat at.
With my cat, we were giving daily subcutaneous fluids. Mm-hmm. Is that one management way, or is that usually the stage 4 type of treatment?
It really depends on the cat. I don't use a lot of subcutaneous fluid therapy and unless the pet feels bad without it. I think that subcutaneous fluids tend to be instituted fairly early in this disease when the values start to go up.
Mm.
And I think that that's not necessarily indicated in every pet with increased kidney values. In your cat's case, it sounds like she really was ill, and those subcutaneous fluids probably were valuable to her in keeping her hydrated and keeping her feeling better and in helping her to want to eat on a daily basis.
Yeah.
So sure, it definitely is something that I'll implement in the later stages of disease.
And how about the earlier stages? What do you do?
Truly, in stage 1 and 2 disease, sometimes even stage 3 disease, the keystone for management is diet. And I get lots of clients who come into me and say, I've read about these renal diets. They're protein restricted. I don't want to restrict protein in my cat. Is there any evidence that really shows that these work? And the answer is unequivocally yes. One of my colleagues actually participated in the recent paper that demonstrated beyond a shadow of a doubt with
grade one outstanding evidence that implementing a renal diet, even in these early stages of disease, gives these cats greater quantity of life and greater quality of life and delays the point to what we call uremic crisis. And what that means is the point at which the cat actually decompensates and becomes ill from the disease.
Mm.
In her own words, the one big flaw of the study was that it didn't go on long enough because the cats on the renal diet never got sick and died.
Wow.
So it truly... And the other misconception that I want to clarify about these diets is they're not really restricted in protein to a degree lower than maintenance needs for a cat. They're just restricted to maintenance needs. Most feline diets on the market contain much more protein than cats require for survival. And so these diets just back that protein back, make it very high-quality protein, and just give them enough to live, but not so much that they're generating excessive nitrogenous waste products that make them feel ill.
And the diet, the food you buy from the vet, or can you get... I know in the market I see for, you know, IMS or one of those others, it says for mm-hmm. urinary health.
And usually those diets for urinary health are targeted toward the diseases we spoke about earlier.
I gotcha. Right, right.
And you cannot buy a diet specifically designed for renal disease in the supermarket. Those are prescription diets that need to be implemented under the direction of a veterinarian.
Mm. How about... go ahead.
No, I was just going to say that there are many of them that are all produced by great pet food companies with lots of good research behind them, and your veterinarian can probably provide you with a variety of options.
How about kidney transplant as a way of management?
Transplantation is a procedure that's been well established in cats, chiefly through the efforts of surgeons at the University of California, Davis over the last 20-25 years. And it's only available now at select centers across the country, but in the right cat and the right circumstances, it can be a valuable procedure. It's very emotionally and financially intensive, and there's no guarantee of success in any given cat, but it definitely is available to the right owners. I guess one thing that I would emphasize is if somebody truly is considering transplant in a kidney failure cat, it is not an emergency procedure. It's not something that we do in a cat with advanced stage 4 disease who is skinny and anemic and ill. It's a procedure to do before the cat gets to that point.
Dr. Julie Fisher from the Veterinary Specialty Hospital in San Diego, North County, thank you so much for sharing your expertise with me and my listeners.
You bet. It was really a pleasure.
Thank you. This is Dr. Lori Kirshner encouraging you to nurture your love and compassion for the only other beings sharing our planet, the animals.